Okay, we're going to concentrate on number 5 and 6 today. Rashi as close reader and Rashi as significant reader. Right. Now, this past week's Parsha has what many scholars consider to be the introduction of Rashi's Perush. While, if you open up in Mikros Gedolos to Bereishis, you will find Ramban has a large introduction. Ibn Ezra has a huge introduction. All the commentaries wrote introductions telling us what their commentary is going to be like. They felt that their readers needed to learn about their agenda. Rashi never wrote an introduction, and in fact, scholars of Rashi consider that Rashi's introduction is just this one line here in this week's parsha. When Adam and Eve realized that there's something different about their experience in the garden after they ate from the tree, it says, this is at the top of this page, take a look, everyone should have this source, these sources here. I gave them out last week and I just passed down a bunch. Okay, yes. It says, Vayishma'u es kol Hashem Elokim mishalech bagan leruach hayom. The English translation expresses, if you don't hear it in the Hebrew, the problem with this pasuk. It says, they heard the voice of Hashem moving in the garden. Now, a voice doesn't move.
Right.
A voice, if you have a shorish, hey lamed chof, you have to have legs to do hey lamed chof.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So, a voice should have been mis mirachefes bagan, something else, but not mis halech bagan. So look what Rashi writes on this. Yesh midrashei agadah rabim. There are many, many midrashim and agadic interpretations of this verse. Ukvar sidrum avoteinu al-mechonam b'vereishit rabbah. And the rabbis give you all sorts of interpretations of the problem of this pasuk and how to deal with it in Bereishis Rabbah. Uvishar midrashot, and you could find them in Shas and Chazal and Agadot, all over the place. Va'ani, however, I lo bossi, now with this little sentence right here, that's Rashi. Ani lo bossi ela lepshuto shel mikra, ula agadah hamiyasheves divrei mikra, davor dabur al ofnov. I am here to give you pshat, and if pshat does not explain adequately what the pasuk is talking about, then I will give you agadah hamiyashevet divrei mikra. Everyone here knows what an agadah is, right? A legend, a deeper midrash, some kind of explanation of the pasuk. Now the important word here is miyasheves. Miyasheves here in the English is called clarify. I would prefer Hebrew word appease. A mikra shetzorich yishuv. The pasuk is unsettled. The pasuk needs to be settled, and that's what devar debor olofnav means. How do you say a bicycle today? Why? Because the wheels are turning. When you hear my perush, the wheels are turning well. This is a pasuk in Mishlei, actually. Devar dabur al ofnav means you may not think that what I'm saying is pshat, but you have to agree that what I'm saying captures the essential words in front of you in the pasuk. Okay. Now, if I asked you in this room, what does the word pshat mean? You could probably tell me simple reading, right? Lavshit means to skin an animal, so pshat is the skin layer of what you're saying, as opposed to a deeper layer, right? Got it? If I said drash, you'd say, okay, drash is a deeper meaning, pshat is the outer meaning, the simple meaning. What does the word mashma'ut mean? When Rashi says, pshuto kimashma'o, what does
it mean?
The meaning, the simple verbal meaning of the word is the pshat. The problem is that very often, the pshat is not the simple meaning of the verse. Like in the pasuk Bereishis Bara Elokim. Bereishis means in the beginning of. So in the beginning of what? The beginning of time, the beginning of creation, the beginning of what? Sometimes there are things missing in the pasuk that you have to fill in. So Rashi tells us here, he doesn't even tell us what this pasuk means. He just says, my purpose in my perush is first to give pshat. The problem is that Rashi, as I said this last week, since Rashi was the first to do this, he moved away from pshat, according to his own grandson, Rashbam, too quickly. He resorted to drash too quickly. And now I want to give some examples of where Rashi resorts to drash very readily, where his own grandson, Rashbam, or Ibn Ezra in some cases, renders what seems to be a simpler pshat, and I'll let you decide which was necessary, or what made Rashi give the midrashic interpretation when pshat seems to have sufficed. Let's give some examples, especially in Sefer Bereishis. So let's start with source number 3 on this first page. Okay. Please, if there's, I know there may be many different levels here in this room, so if I'm going too fast or I need to translate, please, by all means, just raise your hand and I'll know that that's what it means. Okay? So, in the opening, the beginning of the story of Rivka's birth, of her two sons, it says, after she conceived, Vayisrotzitzu habonim bekirba. Here the English reads, the children clashed inside of her. Mm-hmm. There is a general problem, a twofold problem with the word Vayisrotzitzu. One, it's a very unusual description of what unborn children are doing, unborn fetuses. And two, it's a hapax legomena. That means the word never appears again in the Bible. So I don't know what the word is. Is the shorish ratzatz, which means to fight? Is the shorish rutz, resh vav tzadik, which means to run? Rashi apparently was not sure which one it is, if it's to run or to clash. So Rashi gave two interpretations, one that captured each one of these possible roots. And yet both of them defy simple logic. Let's read what Rashi says here. So it's two abanim b'kirba. Is there any... Dora, you always read first, so how about if you read first? Okay. Read the Rashi. He says, Al Korchacha means you must admit. Al Korchacha in the Gemara means against your will. Because most people will to be straight thinkers and pashtanim. But in this case, you must give drash against your will. Right? Because I know you'd rather give pshat, but here you have to give drash. What is it? Shesasam?
Shesasam, ma.
What is this clashing that she says in Kain Lamaze Anochi? When Rivka finally conceived, she looks up to Hashem and she says, Batelech Hidrosh Avim Hashem Lo. She said, the babies were fighting inside her, they're clashing inside her, and she said, God, if this is what I've been praying for, Lamaze Anochi, where do I exist? Not just Lamaze Li, what is this happening to me? Lamaze Anochi, why are you doing this to me? Why am I part of this great clan of these three patriarchs? Why am I doing this, if this is what it means to be a matriarch? Lamaze Anochi. So Rabbi Sena Dorshuhu, a very famous Agadita, that if she would ever pass a place of idolatry, Esav would rush to get out. If she would pass a place of Torah, Yaakov would rush to get out. She didn't realize she's carrying twins, so she's wondering, you know, this is the deeper meaning of this drash. What kind of baby is this? Rushing to get to Avodah Zarah, rushing to get to a base medrash? You know, how can you have this? Right? So anyway, she was just, the pain was so great that she had to ask about this, because look what's going on here. Now, this defies logic for a number of reasons. One, unborn fetuses don't have a Yetzirah. They know when their mother's walking around this way and that way. How can Rashi record such a thing? All right, it didn't take it. This is not from himself. I told you last week Rashi would never say something like this if it wasn't in a Medrash before. He says, Rabbi Hussein Udorshu, right? And notice that he started off... But notice that he started off by saying Mahi Ritzitza Zu, and then he says, Chazal, Rabbi Hussein Udorshu Lashon Ritza. They're not fighting. They're running. They're not fighting here. You go your way, I'll go my way. Right? They're not clashing. Right? So that's the first interpretation. This interpretation doesn't have them fighting. Esav will go his place, and Yaakov will go his place. Second interpretation says Davar Acher, and now he uses the Shoresh Ritzitza. Here they're fighting. over who's going to be... What are they fighting over? Who's getting out first? The irony is that their mother is about to be told, Virav Ya'avod Tsa'ir, the younger one, is going to prepare. All right, that's for a narrative. It means that whoever comes out first is going to inherit. So both of these perushim of Rashi are certainly midrashic in nature. When I say midrashic, because it's not implied in the text that this is what they're fighting over, right? But Yisro Tzitzu does seem to imply that they're moving around, right? Are you familiar with the scientific fact that many more twins are conceived than are born?
Yeah.
Many more. What happens?
One dies.
One does not make it. They struggle. In the very early part of the pregnancy, their mom is struggling. They stroke for two. They're struggling inside for nutrients that are normally for one, right? And now they have to share. So if there's a stronger one, that stronger one actually doesn't, obviously not with intention, but wins out and ends up coming out alone. Right? This happens in the first few days or weeks of the pregnancy. The woman may not even realize she's pregnant at that point. But this often happens. So the concept of Vayisro Tzitzu Abonim B'Kirba, the way Rashi presents it, is, believe it or not, not so distant from the actual MS as we see it. But Rashi has it as something done by intent. And these babies are not doing this with certainly not with malicious intent. They're not struggling or fighting, but they are in some way. However, I would like to present to you, if you turn the page... Oh, no, I'm sorry, it's not here. I would like to present to you just by heart the opinion of Rashi's grandson over what it means to be Vayisro Tzitzu Abanim B'Kirba. I'll quote him. Hayu misna'anin b'soch me'eho k'derech ha'ubrim. Hear that again? Hayu misna'anin b'soch me'eho k'derech ha'ubrim. Can someone translate that for me? Tell me what they just said. The two of them were moving around inside their mother. Kiderech. I want you to remember that word in Rashbam, because when we do Rashbam next month, you'll see he uses that word a lot.
On
he the likes
road?
The word kiderech. Kiderech means that's the way it is. That's the way of the world. Derech Eretz. Things that Rashi uses monumental midrashim to explain, Rashbam says, what are you talking about? That's the way it is. That's the derech. That's the derech of the world. Babies move around inside their mother. Ask any woman who ever bore twins, and she'll tell you that they were moving around in there all the time. One, your woman will remember moving around quite a bit. Two, okay. Of course, they'll remember kicking, they'll remember them moving around. So the question is, if it's such an obvious thing to Rashbam, whenever Rashbam uses the word derech in his commentary, that means that he feels that this is the simple, simple pshat. No need for a gavata. So our question returns to Rashi. Why did Rashi feel the need to tell us not only this drash that I just read, these two perushim, but al korchach, he said, you must, against your will, you must darshan. And Rashi's own grandson said, I don't see a need to darshan.
Well, obviously, if it's so common, then why have it even in the Torah?
That's it. Rashi said those words. He says those words, Shestam Mahi Ratzitza Zuvikosavim Kane Lamazanochi. If this was my grandson, you don't think I could come up with that? If this was a common occurrence, Kederecha Ubrim, why is the Torah giving Rivka this editorial of what it feels like to be pregnant? She's not the first person to carry twins, not the last, and the Torah could have just had the story go like this. Yitzchak was 40 years old, he married Rivka. She went 20 years without conceiving. They prayed, and God blessed her, and she gave birth to two boys. The first one came out all right, right? Right. Now, it's true that if it had just done it that way, we wouldn't have the oracle from before of her knowing which one is going to be greater. All right, so don't tell us how she came to have a conversation with God. Just say God came down to Rivka. However it is, God came down and said, Rivka, you go. Guess what? You're having twins. Yeah. How she came to know she's having twins? Why should we feel that she was the one who initiated the conversation because of her pain in birth? If not, Rashi says that it was something extraordinary that no woman ever experienced. That's the difference between Rashi and Rashbam. That is number five. Actually, six. Rashi as significant reader. To Rashi, the text must have significance. Right?
But these kids had propensity inside before.
Okay, well, we'll let the Talmud debate that. I just want to say the pshat. Okay? Now, we'll learn when we do Ramban that while Rashi certainly started this concept of making sure everything in the text reads significantly, there's nothing in passing, right? And we'll see many examples of this. The one who explained the biblical text with what some scholars call omni-significance is Ramban. Right? In that same parsha, Ramban talks about Avram digging out three wells as representatives of the three temples. And Ramban does this throughout Sefer Bereishis, where he shows that events, simple events that take place in Sefer Bereishis, are blueprints for Jewish history, in some cases world history. In the most amazing way, but that's tangential to our discussion now. And on this page, if you want to look ahead for that time, it's page 2. This Ramban, source number 5, and it's translated for you. Okay, now last week I used source number 6 on page 2. Everyone should turn to it. I used this source number 6 on page 2 as an example of where Rashi will disagree with the Gemara if he feels the Gemara does not adequately capture the essence of the words of the pasuk. Remember last week when we talked about how they were able to hide Moshe for 3 months? And the Gemara gave one answer, and Rashi gave a totally different answer because it did not fit. The Gemara's answer did not fit the words of the pasuk. I'm using this now to teach something else. Let's read the pasuk. It's Vayelech Ish mi Beit Levi, Vayikach et Bat Levi. A man from the house of Levi married a daughter of Levi. She gave birth to a boy, and we know that boy was Moshe. The reader of the text is not just bothered by the fact that it says Vayelech Ish mi Beit Levi. What's that extra Vayelech doing? Right? The reader of the text is bothered with another glaring omission. I should say omissions. A man married a daughter of Levi. I know that who they are. That's Amram and Yocheved, right? Moshe's parents. She conceived and bore a child. They hid the child for 3 months. What's missing? Okay, that's for sure. Why no names? Just say a man named Amram married a woman named Yocheved. But what's even more glaringly missing? There are two older siblings, we find out later. And don't tell me it's because this is a second marriage to only one of them. Right? This is the first marriage to him. Because it says in Parshas Pinchas, Yocheved and Amram had Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. They're the children of both of them. Right? So why does the Torah just totally miss Miriam and Aaron and go straight to the third child? If you were dealing with that question, how would you answer? If you were an ultimate Pashtan, if you're a Shpam, you're Ibn Ezra, how do you answer the question? Why does it say a man married this woman and they had a baby and that's Moshe? Where are the others? The others aren't significant. In this particular case, we don't need to know about the birth of Aaron and Miriam. We also don't need to know about the birth of Avraham. We don't need to know about the birth of David. We do need to know about the birth of Shmuel and Shimshon and Yitzchak. I don't know why. I mean, I can read the text and see their births. I don't know why I wasn't told about the birth of Aaron. It was not important for the Torah to give it to me. So that's the Ramban, that's Ibn Ezra, that's Rashbam. Rashi didn't like that. Rashi wanted to create a background to this story, that this was a second marriage. That this couple was married before. Remember I told you they were divorced for 3 months. She was already pregnant, according to the Gemara, from before. Which didn't fit, Rashi says, the fact that the second pasuk begins with the word Batahar, she conceived. Right? That's why he rejected that. Remember last week. So here we're told that a man from the house of Levi married this daughter of Levi. He went and married her. That's the Vayelech. Right? So the commentaries first deal with the word Vayelech. Right? Why does it say Vayelech Ish mi Beit Levi? Vayikach et bat Levi. The first thing in Parshanut is to do the following. What is the Pasuk saying? How could it have said it more easily? And why did it use an extra word? The Pasuk should have said, Vayikach ish mi beit Levi et bat Levi. Why does it say, Vayelech ish mi beit Levi vayikach et bat? A man went from the house of Levi and married the daughter of Levi. Right? So let's see what this source number 6 says. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi. Rabotenu Umru. There's quite a bit of scholarship on these two words, Rabotenu Umru, because what we're about to read appears in Rashi. It says Rabotenu Umru, and it appears in Rashi. Ramban was a very good and precise quoter of Rashi. Scholars consider what Ramban writes about Rashi to be as reliable as Savyad. This is an original manuscript copied, of course, of Rashi. That when Ramban cites Rashi, he is reading it not from his memory, not from his handwritten notes, from a manuscript of Rashi. He had Rashi open in front of him.
Ramban?
I'll explain this. These are manuscripts of Rashi. Ramban, Nachmanides. So why does he write Rabotenu Amru when what we're about to read appears in Rashi? You know why? Because it's not Rashi. I mean, it's amazing. Ramban quotes it as Rabotenu. If you open up a Mikros Gedolos or a Chumash on this Pasuk,
you won't find it.
No, you will find it. It's just, it's not really Rashi. How do I know that? Because in the newer versions of Rashi, it says Rashi Yashan. You ever hear of that? Old Rashi.
Right?
Many people think Rashi Yashan was like the first volume of Rashi. Rashi's works were destroyed by Christian censors. So they say those were the earlier manuscripts of Rashi. How do we know what they were? They were destroyed. No. Rashi Yashan, I'm going to prove probably next week, was a man named Rav Yitzchok, lived many years after Rashi, and somehow his works got into some of Rashi's Perushim and came to be known as Rashi Yashan. He signed his name Reish Yud, right? Mm-hmm. And people made the mistake of thinking it's Rashi Yashan. There was a code of honor when you were writing inside someone's manuscript, or you, let's say I want to copy this over in my handwriting, and I want to write my own notes on the side. Like here, you see some notes on the side. The code of honor was you had to write your initials to clearly delineate for someone who might find this 200 years from now that what's in here are the words of Rashi, and what you wrote are your notes. You following? Otherwise, you know, when a printing press, so if I'm reading in this book, no one's going to think that my handwritten notes on the side really are the same as the print, right? But when everything is handwritten, you have to be careful. You can get your words into someone else's writing, and someone 100 years later is going to think that that's the original author's words. So you always had to write your initials. Someone caught not doing that would be total suicide, scholarly suicide. No one would read your works. So this guy Rav Yitzchok did the honorable thing. He wrote Reish Yud, but people mistook it to be Rashi Yashan. I'll explain why we know that. But the point I'm saying is that even though what I'm about to read does appear in Rashi, it's not Rashi. Shehalach achar atzat bito. Shehalach achar atzat bito. According to this, you're familiar with the Agadah that Amram led a group of men to divorce their wives, right? I mentioned this last week. And he was convinced by Miriam to remarry his wife, her mother. So, Vayelech ish mi beit Levi. Can you figure out midrashically, what does it mean? A man from the house of Levi went after his daughter's advice. He took his daughter's advice, he went after it. Halach ba'atzat bito. And that's why Vayelech is in the Pasuk. This ingeniously answers both questions. So why isn't Aaron and Miriam mentioned? Why aren't they mentioned?
They were born already
from before. This is a second marriage. This marriage's first birth was Moshe. So there's nothing being skipped here. And it explains not only why Aaron and Miriam aren't mentioned, it explains why the extra Vayelech is there. Beautiful. Now look what happens next. Now I'm skipping over to Ibn Ezra now for a reason. You'll see why. Rabbi Avraham Amar.
Where is this?
This is number 6, still number 6.
No.
Rabbi Avraham Amar, this is Reish Aleph in Ramban, is Ibn Ezra. Okay?
So that's not Abbasin Ramban.
It's a little early.
Oh.
Reish Aleph is Rabbi Avraham Amar, that's Ibn Ezra. Okay? Ki be'orim rabot hayu Yisrael yoshvim. The Jews lived in many different cities in Egypt. It says Vatim Olei Haaretz al Sam, right? So the Jews lived in many cities. V'zot ha'isha ha'ita b'ir acheret. He went on a shidduch date. He traveled from one city to another to meet her. And that's why it says Vayelach. Okay, you see it? Mm-hmm. That's why it says Vayelach. He traveled from one place to another to marry her. Now, who does a better job of explaining why Vayelech is in the Pasuk? Rashi or Shan, or whatever, Rabotenu? Or, now, Rashi, by the way, agrees that it was a second marriage.
Who gives a better shot?
the drash of Vayelech, of it introducing a second marriage, is that's what it is, it's drash. But the pshat, he traveled from one place to another. Look at Ramban's objection to that. The same problem. What's the significance of such a thing?
What do you care?
When Hashem tells Moshe, go down to Paro, to the Nile in the morning, right? And turn the water to blood. So Rashi, his ear tingles. You see, we have to start reading Bible like Rashi. Why do I have to know what time of day Hashem is telling Moshe to go down to Paro? Remember the Rashi?
No, that's when the water is gathered.
No, Paro would go to relieve himself in the morning, like everyone has to do after a full night's sleep. But he wouldn't do it in his own place, because then people would think, oh, he's human like the rest of us.
Uh-huh.
He would go inside his God, I guess. I mean, it's okay to do it inside God, yeah? Inside the Nile they worship. But you see, Rashi says, I have to explain why, if the Pasuk could just as well have said, go down to the Nile and turn it to blood, why did he have to say, go down to the Nile in the morning? He's going down to the water, turn it to blood. Right? I want you to, if Hashem is his God, and while he's behaving like afraid to behave like a human being, and show him who's boss. Right? But Ibn Ezra writes, it's very pleasant to take a walk by water in the morning when you wake up. Kings like to do it. Okay. It's nice.
So, yeah, but why bother? Right.
In truth, Ibn Ezra does say it in another place in Shmos that Egyptian kings to this day measure the Nile at different times of the year to see how much it's overflowing, and it could be that that's what he's doing. But doesn't explain why it was in the morning. Why should you do that in the morning more than any other time of the day? So Rashi, again, and it may be more drash than you'd like, right? But at least it answers the questions of extraneous material. So this is Rashi as significant reader. Let's go back to Rashi as close reader.
Did he read that from somewhere else in the Midrash, or did he make it up himself?
Rashi will never make something like that. So maybe you can count on one hand Perushim like this that we somehow cannot find an earlier source than Rashi. And even those, the assumption in scholars is that the source was once there, we just don't have it now. I'll give you one. When Yaakov tells Esav, Im Lavan Garti, and he says, Taryag Mitzvos Shamarti, there seems to be no Mokor in Chazal that has Yaakov telling Esav, I kept the Taryag Mitzvos in Lavan's house. How can you? It's outside of Israel. And you married two sisters. Where's your Taryag Mitzvos? Right, so the whole point is that they didn't keep the mitzvahs outside of Israel, and he was outside of Israel. But so that apparently does not have a source, an earlier source. I know why he says it, because it says im lavan garti va'echar ad oto. It should have said either im lavan garti ad oto or im lavan echarti ad oto. But why im lavan garti va'echar ad oto? Right, Rashi gives another interpretation to this because he realizes that that's very tenuous. But it was just so juicy, garti, taryag. It was so there. But Rashi says elsewhere. He says just a few psukim later. He says, "Listen, my brother, father told me in the blessing I took from you. Remember when I dressed up like you? He said, Heve gevir la'achecha, that I should rule over you. Who's ruling over him? I'm bowing to you, right?" Father said, Tala Shemayim and Shemane Ha'aretz. I'm just a ger. A ger has no land. Right? He's trying to convince you with every single word, Rashi says, to convince him that the brachas that I took from you back in Parshas Toldos have not come true, therefore don't kill me and my family.
Right.
Okay, anyway,
Wasn't so, Ibn Ezra before Rashi?
No. Ibn Ezra was born in 1089, Rashi was born in 1040.
Oh.
Now, Ibn Ezra might have known Rashi's grandson, Rashbam. They might have had some association. Although we'll see that there was nothing but enmity between the two.
Did Rashi interpret stuff like he was competing against the church? So be very careful how he...
Yes, I actually talked about that this Sunday, this past Shabbos, and that is... I did not put into this discussion Rashi as polemicist, simply because I discussed so much of that last year. We touched upon a little bit of it last week when we talked about the movement of Pshat, which was influenced by polemics. So whether Rashi himself, I'll just say it right now. There are some opinions that Rashi did a lot of that. That Rashi polemicized very much against Christian theology. The reason for that is because the Jews in France and Germany at this time had to sit through sermons on Shabbos. The priests made their way into Shul and made them sit through an hour-long sermon about why Christianity is right, why Jesus is the coming of God, why etc., etc., and why Yaakov behaves immorally and he takes advantage of Esav the way you take advantage of us in business and other things like that. And the Jews were overcome with this, and you couldn't go to Kiddush Club during these speeches. You had to stand to pack the Shul and listen to the speech. Right?
Yep.
So you can understand that some of the commentaries living at this kind of time would try to give explanations of the biblical text that worked away from these forced interpretations that the Jews were listening to. Okay, so there's one opinion. Another opinion is that Rashi never polemicized. Rashi is pure parshanut. It's very difficult to prove that someone is saying something against a Christian theology unless he goes out and says that Christians say this and I say they're wrong. If anyone was at my shiur Shabbos morning at 8:45, I talked about that this past Shabbos morning.
Yep.
So I gave four or five perushim in Parshas Bereishis alone, where Rashi seems to clearly be saying something that is meant to be against Christian theology. So I'm against those who say Rashi does it a lot. I'm against those who say he doesn't. He never does it. I think Rashi does it to a minimum. I think his grandson, Rashbam, there I'm going to bring it out. Rashbam polemicizes against Christianity plenty. And he has to do it very carefully, because in the year 1100, if you are found to outright write something in a biblical commentary that is damaging to Jesus or Christianity, you remember last year these discussions, right? This was a whole year was on this last year, right? They'd kill you and burn your commentary and they'd burn down your town. Right? You could not write things outright against Christianity. Or if you did, then you got away with it. That's just amazing. Right? So if you wanted to write something that flies in the face of Christian theology, you'd better write it as flying in the face of idolatrous theology. Use the word akum, don't use the word goy. Right? You have to be very careful about how you express that. Okay, I must move to number 5, which is going backwards. It says, Rashi as close reader, mashma'ut and parallelism. Okay, now, a close reader means that, literally, you're reading the pasuk closely. Let me give some good examples here. Let's do number 18 and 19. Moshe came to Paro and demanded the freedom of his people. Paro said, "Show me a sign that you have something serious behind you." Like Moshe tells Aaron, "Throw down your staff," right? And then Paro's men, at least two of them, threw down their rods, and they became serpents. However, vayivla matei Aharon es matosam. Aaron's staff swallowed their staffs. Okay. Look what Rashi writes on that. Vayivla matei Aharon. Alan, you want to say something? 19. Yachar?
Yachar shechazar v'nasa matei Aharon et kulan.
What's interesting on this pasuk is that Ibn Ezra cites this opinion in the name of someone else. An unknown Rishon. I mean, we've heard of him, Ibn Ezra, named Rabbi Yeshua. Some say he's a Karaite, he's not. He's a relative unknown commentary that lived around the time of Rashi, named Rabbi Yeshua. Why quote Rabbi Yeshua when it's Rashi? Better yet, better than that, why quote Rabbi Yeshua when it's a Gemara? It's a Gemara Masechet Shabbos. So you should see what some of the scholars say about Ibn Ezra. A, he is the only commentary of note. He's certainly a noteworthy commentary. In the last 800 years, Christian or Jew, who cared to write a significant commentary to the Torah, can anyone finish my sentence, without bothering to read Rashi first. He didn't care for Rashi. Ibn Ezra does this so often in his commentary. About 100 times in his commentary, he quotes something Rashi says in the name of someone else. You know how many times he quotes Rashi by name in his parish to the Torah? Twice. We have his second one only to Shmos. But yes. Everybody on every Jew on earth had access to Rashi's works by the time of Ibn Ezra. There's no he was so famous.
Oh really?
Rashi was famous in his lifetime. Poor Ibn Ezra wasn't. Poor Ibn Ezra died. Probably wondering why he's not famous.
poor and unknown.
I'm sorry, what? Ibn Ezra died 350 years before the invention of the printing press.
I'm saying, so
when someone was at Rashi was already world famous at the age of 25.
Wow!
So he was just fame spread, and he was extremely humble at the same time. You should know
he was
but
what
extremely humble at the same time. But Ibn Ezra
was gracious.
I have a whole book of stories of the unknown nature of Ibn Ezra and his travels. He traveled the world, and he went from place to place. Writing about how upset he is that he's not known. and lessons he tried to teach the people in various places about that. Apparently, according to one or two Rishonim, he married the daughter of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi late in life and came to some, at least finally, some wealth and some sipuka nefesh and some little rest in his life. Yes, much.
As this is pre-printing press, what were the actual mechanics of how Rashi's manuscripts got copied all over the world?
Scrupulous copyists who
was there any
central
guild of Jewish sofrim who did it in an organized manner, or was it really just ad hoc?
Something. This manuscript that I have here. Let me just. This I love this one because it's dated. 1233. This is this manuscript here, which was must have been commissioned by a wealthy person. This is Rashi's commentary to Sefer Melachim, that's all. And it must have been a wealthy person because the commentary of Rashi is usually written with some kind of micrography, like a key or a cup or a candle or something like that. You see, this must have been an intricate.
What year is it?
1233. Now that's significant because for hundreds of years, 600 to 700 years, it was always assumed that no commentary of Rashi was found before the year 1240. Now you heard these dates. Rashi was born in 1040. Rashi died 1105. His works were so just meticulously destroyed by the French. You know the French had very famous widespread book burnings. Of Jewish works, and no coincidence, 1240, 1238, that was the famous book burning in Paris, right? That probably destroyed everything before it. This is what we would call an Udmut Salmeish. This is precedes that book burning. It's obviously a copy of something. The original, each one of these pages, if you have the original, goes for like $50,000. They sell page by page. Right? They sell the whole thing for, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, he had an opportunity to buy that for the whole whole lot in Sotheby's for like $20 million last year. I don't know if it's still available. Anyway, so Moshe, this might be a school child. Something. This probably not because of the intricate way that the parish is written, but this one might be. These are four different kisvei yad to Rashi to Sefer Melachim. This is also, I could tell, was done less expensively because this has the text of Melachim, the Targum, and Rashi. This just has Rashi, only Rashi to Sefer Melachim. So who wants to just buy Rashi? You know, you have. No, we assume that you have the Tanakh at home. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even tell you which pasuk. It just says the Dibra Maska. It's really difficult. This is dated 1298. So I have four different skisviyat of Rashi to say from Malachim here. So let's get back to the quote. So it says, "Vayivla matei Aharon meachar shechozar v'nasa matei balas kulon." Ibn Ezra cites a Rabbi Yeshua because he probably didn't see that it was Rashi. Okay. So what is Rashi saying? Is that the staff opened up, the rod opened up a little hole and they started chomping on the other ones.
Yeah,
not like in the movie where it says, "Hey, this snake is swallowing the other snakes." Remember that? Mm-hmm. So it's not. That's not what Rashi says. It's the staff that ate the two other staffs. As a staff, not as a snake.
As a staff?
After it became a rod again.
Yeah, after it became a rod again, it swallowed all the others. What?
It was a snake at some point.
Okay, that's for sure. But why does Rashi say such a thing? Ibn Ezra cites this and he says, "Ze pele gadol." I disagree with it. Ibn Ezra is very famous for downplaying, like Sadia Gaon before him and other Sfaradim, downplaying miracles of the Bible. Ibn Ezra says, "I can't believe a staff opened up a mouth and chomped the staff. A snake, all right, that's pretty miraculous, but snakes can do that. They can swallow a sheep. So they swallow two other snakes." All right? So, why is Rashi saying this?
And this is Matei Aharon, to be literal.
Yeah. And Aaron's staff swallowed their staffs. Rashi said, "Don't look at me, I'm just reading the pasuk."
Shot.
Yeah, well, you know what? I don't know. Is that shot or is it just mashmaut? It's just the meaning of the words before you.
Right, snapshot.
Snapshot. Shot is that the stick ate a stick. I'll prove it to you. Mm-hmm. All right? Torah says that if you want to be a nazir, you have to let your hair grow. Mm-hmm. You can't drink wine. You can't come to death defilement. It says after your tenure as a nazir, right? It says in the Torah, "Achar yishte hanazir yayin." After he's finished, the nazir shall drink wine. Mm-hmm. One piece of the Gemara says he has to. I want you to get back to the world and drink wine again, right? Just now with moderation. So, but wait a second. Why are you calling him a nazir? Uh-huh. He's not a nazir anymore.
Right.
How can you say achar yishteh nazir yayin? Say achar yishteh ha'ish yayin. So why do you say achar yishteh nazir yayin? Because
he once was, just before.
That's how we know him in this story. So that's how we know that you wouldn't say in Aaron's. What would you expect it to say? Aaron's snake ate their snakes?
Right. They're right. The snake that came from his staff ate the one.
What do you want to say? If it's, right. I know, even though you're telling me Aaron's staff, I know you mean it as a snake.
Right.
What do you expect the pasuk to say? Right. And yet, Rashi is such a close reader of the text that he made, because while Ibn Ezra likes to downplay miracles, Rashi loves to make the miracle greater and greater. Okay, let's see some more examples of this, and let's turn back a little. Let's look at some examples from this week's parsha. Source number 7 says,
Noah.
Vayavo Noah uvanav. Can you read, Leah?
Vayavo Noah uvanav v'ishto unshei vanav ito el hateva mitnei mei hamabul.
All right, so Noah, his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, right? They went with him onto the ark. In our narrative, the year we did narrative, we would have noticed why is this a plural subject, right? Noach ubanav, right? There's eight people on the subject, and it gets a singular verb. It should be vayavo'u. Right? All right, but that's not the kind of thing that Rashi comments on. This is number 7.
Why doesn't Rashi comment on that? It's a contradiction.
It's not the kind of thing that he notices.
Grammar is not.
Rashi certainly. Although I don't have him as grammarian, I have his philologist. But Rashi certainly cares about grammar. There's no question about that. But this is something Rashi just took so much for granted. I must admit there were some times like when Yefet and Shane in this week's parsha grab a blanket and cover their father's nakedness, right? There Rashi does notice. Why does it say Vayikach Shein Vayefet?
It's a similar.
It should say Vayikhu. There Rashi does care to bring it to your attention. You know what? Tell me why. What's internal in the story that makes you say, that makes Rashi say Vayikach is singular because only Shein was doing it, really. Shein called him to do it, and Yefet just says, okay, you need me to hold your blanket, I'll do it. Why?
Because
what's internal to the story?
Because Shem is the one who gets the bracha.
Right. Because if both Shem and Yefet took the blanket to cover their father's nakedness, why does Noach, when he wakes up, he gives a whole big, huge mishaberach to Shem, and Yefet is just like a nachschlepper. So Vayikach tells the reader that only one of them is acting. Now, while it's true that sometimes you have, especially with Aaron and Moshe, throughout the 10 plagues, Vayavo Moshe v'Aaron, Vayushav Moshe v'Aaron, Vayal Moshe v'Aaron, singular and plural, yet singular verb, yet a plural subject, there, Rashi sums it even once, Rashi says, yeah, Kleiv Echad, Ish Echad, all acting as one. So you can have both interpretations, either that only stresses one of the few that are there, one of the many, or one that stresses they're all acting in unison. But here, that's not Rashi's concern here. All right, Rashi is concerned with another thing, a moral issue. Because when they leave the ark, read source number 9, Liam.
Source number 9. Say min ha-teva ata ve-ishtecha uvanecha unshei vanecha itach.
Okay, when you start to read Rashi, you'll start to read the text like this before you get to Rashi. What's the issue in this pasuk?
You and your wife, of course, it's in a different order now.
Right, this time it's...
It's man, wife, you know, husband, wife, husband, wife.
Okay, so we read number 8. 8 is Rashi's comment on
this. There it's all the males and then the females.
Right. In the Lashon of the Medrash, I'm destroying. Do you want to build?
You're separate.
Right? Wait till after the anger passes. When you leave the teva, then... Okay. Right, Hanashimlavad, Rashi not only notices the fact that the order is different and he explains it, but he gives that little kvetch at the end. Mipnesha alom ha'olam sharui bitzar. Rashi could have just said, listen guys, this is what it is. The ark is not a place for you to to have your own pleasure while I'm destroying the world.
Do you think that this pastor of Rashi thought the Torah is coming to teach you? Never mind, it's Pashup Shat. I mean, but
it's interesting. Rashi is a little different than the Medrash said, I'm destroying, you don't build. Right? In other words, according to that interpretation, they wouldn't even be able to have, artificial you wouldn't be able to have any in vitro fertilization. You wouldn't be able to produce it, and even in a way where it doesn't involve pleasure. So here Rashi is giving a different interpretation. It's not a question of destroying and rebuilding before while God is destroying. God said Puravu when they left the ark, right? So here Rashi says, there in the world is being destroyed. You should be having ta'anug while that's happening. Okay. All right, let's see another example like this. Take a look at source number 11. Two tribes wanted land outside of Israel proper. And they give the reason for wanting it there. Okay. Any takers to read, Matthew? 11? Do you have it? 7. Okay, so Moshe told them, if you want land outside of Israel proper, where your brethren helped to conquer, back in Parshas Chukas, right? So it wouldn't be fair for you to just take your land now and just stay there. You have to help the other tribes inherit their land, right? In Canaan.
Right.
Proper. So, yes, Dan?
The question I have about that. About this whole arrangement they made, just the women and the children were going to defend the land while the men were away?
Well, it's a good question. They just assumed that we so profoundly conquered this land that they're safe here. Yeah, that's a good question. So he said, we're going to build fences for our cattle, right, and cities for our children, and then we'll help conquer Canaan, and we'll come return. So Moshe gave them a long speech about their obligations, and this is the last line. Continue reading 12. Tasu. What happened here?
reverse the order.
So here too, look at read Rashi number 13.
Children first.
אמר להם משה לא כנסו, האישה יקרס, והשפל תפל. תנו לכם תחילה, ערים את אביכם, ואחר כן כדי לא לתלכם.
That's great, great accent, I love it. So he says that you're making a big mistake. You said we'll build fences for our cattle first. Look what happened. You wanted the land outside of Israel proper. You made your parnosa to be such an important thing. It has taken precedence over your children. Very powerful message, we all know. Yeah. You know, you ask the man, well, how come you never spend time with your kids? Well, I'm working so hard so my kids can get to the best school and the best camp, and but they never see you. They just want a little time with you. Right? So they said, just take care of the kids first. Moshe changed the order. Now, is this pshat? Was this pshat by the case of Noah's Ark and here? Why doesn't even Ezra and Rishpam go along with this? I don't know if they think it's pshat. I think one of these is pshat. You see a similar case where Rashi notices a change in order from the way they go on the ark and the way they go off the ark, from the way the Reuben and Gad say that we'll take care of the cattle and children, the way Moshe says to take care of the cattle and children. Which would you say is I think one is pshat and one is drash. I think one of these is real pshat.
Noah is maybe real pshat.
Tell me why.
Because it fits with the fact that they come off and then there's the whole story and what happens afterwards, and clearly they're repopulating the earth, whereas it's a pure guess as to why, you know, why Moshe reversed the order. Moshe doesn't say why you reversed
the order.
Can
you picture an Ibn Ezra saying, stop bothering me with these pontifications of what they did on the ark. This is the way they went on and this is the way they went off.
Yeah.
But then you might answer like a Ramban. Who cares? Just say they went on, and they all went on, and they all went off.
Right.
Yeah, there's got to be a better reason for the change in order. But that's okay. Even though we can agree that this was historically accurate, and this is exactly the way it was, the way it was can be determined by drash as much as by pshat. Anyone have a different opinion? Yes.
I think in the case of Reuben, Gad, and Moshe, he's intentionally inverting their words.
But don't you see that what Moshe is doing there in that story is teaching them their obligations to their families and to their people. That can be part of such a message. But in the case of going on and off the ark,
that's
who's talking about marital relations?
That's Moshe himself.
That's who also. That's who.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Here, it's who's talking about their marital relations. But still, there's got to be some reason to a close reader why you have that different order. Ibn Ezra often says, "I know it's a different order. Stop hocking me." That's just the way it was.
Yeah, but wait a second.
They could have said that.
That's the way, I understand. They're going to go wild. They're going to go all over the place. They're not going to stay.
It's not a question of they're going to build it. The question of which one goes first. Yes.
I think maybe this is the Cuban Rabbi Ishmael.
Yes, going to come next week. Or 2 weeks.
Each word is in the Torah for a reason.
Yes.
One says just that's the way people...
Exactly. Stanley hit it right in the head, is that Rabbi Ishmael is of the opinion that things get repeated without any particular reason. They're just deeper Torah, l'sham b'nei Adam. Rabbi Akiva is the one who tries to pinpoint every single word. That Rashi is more like Rabbi Akiva. And yes, and Rashbam is more like Rabbi Ishmael. We'll see other examples of that. Let me just end with one quick example. I'll just do this one, number 15. I'll just do it quickly because I see our time is up. When Moshe was standing at the burning bush, Hashem told him, put your hand inside your...
Right.
Here, right? And now take it out. And it was leprosy, right? Mm-hmm. And Hashem says, now put it back in, take it out, and it was flesh again. You know that story, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, it's an amazing anomaly of the biblical text. When Hashem tells Moshe, put your hand in, and then Hashem says, now take it out, it says, Vayotzi'o, Vihine Mitzora Kashelik. The next time Hashem says, now put your hand back in, and now Hashem says, take your hand back out, and it says, Vayotzi'o Micheko, Vihine Kshava Kivsaro. No one notices that difference, but someone whose antenna are up like Rashi, and now you, say, why is it that when he put his hand in the first time, it said, Vayotziya. The second time, Vayotziya Micheko. I just say Vayotziya both times, it's Vayotziya Micheko both times. I know he took it out of his pocket both times. Right? So why do you have to say it? So look what Rashi writes in number 15. Mikan, whenever Rashi uses the word Mikan, lift up your own antenna. Mikan is a sign in Rashi that he is teaching you a moral lesson. It's a buzzword. It's a famous word in Rashi. Mikan, or Zebal Lamdenu, or things like that. Mikan, Shemidah Tova Memaheres Lavo Mimidas Puranus. Good things happen faster than bad things. Is this always true? I don't know. I don't know. I take Rashi's word for it. What's my proof? But he says, here is a good raya that good things happen faster than bad things. Why? Shaharei barishona lo ne'emar micheko. And I'm left, what does that mean? Vayotziya, vayotziya micheko. So this is what the Meforshim say it means. And then I'm going to try to give my own shot. Not to say that I'm preferable to Rashi. But vayotziya micheko means this. Vayotziya means he took his hand out. Right? Vayotziya is this. Mm-hmm. Right? Means that's vayotziya. Vayotziya micheko is this. Vayotziya micheko.
In other words, sooner. Year,
it became from good, which is flesh, to leprosy, which is bad. Vayotziya. That's vayotziya. Vayotziya micheko is sooner. Does anybody have a different interpretation of this, Rashi? Please help me. Second one happens faster. When it turns from Tsaras back to his hand, it says, V'yotzeh Micheko, V'yinei Shova Kivsaro.
As soon as it left.
The first time.
As soon as
okay,
it left.
So now I want to say a pshat. Now I want to say a pshat. When Hashem told Moshe, put your hand in your pocket. Now he says, now take your hand out. At that point, Moshe didn't know what's going to... Maybe he's going to have a rabbit holding the rabbit by his ears.
Exactly.
Maybe he's going to have a bouquet of roses.
Whatever.
Maybe a pigeon. He doesn't know what's going to be in his hand, right? So he says, Be'otziya, and so he takes it. Oh, whoa, look at my hand. Oh. He goes, calm down, Moshe. Put your hand back. And he goes, now take your hand back out. I'm sure the second time he took it out was slow.
That's right. He's making sure. He's like, hello, what are you?
So now, I have a cloud gadol. I teach Rashi every day of the year for 25 years.
I live
Rashi. I assume that whatever I think of the biblical text, Rashi thought so too. So why didn't Rashi say this? You started saying it. When he put his hand out the second time,
right.
He took it out more slowly.
No, he expected to see.
This first time he didn't know what to expect, so he took it all out.
Right.
Second time he was worried. What does it look like? I just saw this white flesh dripping from me. And I'm like, So he took it out. So why didn't Rashi write that? Rashi makes up a pshat sometimes. It's true. This parish is in the Medrash. It's true.
He expected it?
He was expecting God told him to put his hand in and make that. So he should have already been looking for something.
Okay, but still, he, in other words, you say even a second time when he took it out, but he knew what his hand looked like, so he was...
I know where
there's nothing to learn from that.
The first time it might have been the same thing because he was told to put his hand in and then take it out. So
but still take it out means, you know, he just, it's probably the way he would normally do it. I mean, it's...
There's nothing to learn from that. So
that's
you're
it!
Scared, so what?
That's it! This is number seven. So what? That's back to what we said before! There's nothing to learn from that! Okay, he took it out slowly, he took it out fast, he was worried. Come on! I have something to teach here! Yidden! Hope for the good. Rashi is a mechanich. He wants to give you not only a biblical text, he wants you to go home and feel good about it after you learn it. And hope that these guys who have such trouble at the pogrom, I heard they went to the next city and they're destroying that city and tribe, Israel, and oh goodness, where was it? Oh, but Rashi said good things are going to happen quickly. All right, let's hope. All right, and it passed by their town. All right, so in other words, I have to, I'm giving hope
to
people.
Life is about despair. The
order
of how they walked out. Right? Off
the ark during destruction.
Right. So that happens to be a halacha, by the way, in time of famine, in time of great tsar, we should not have tanug in general. But Rashi is just saying something historically for that time period. But when Rashi has an opportunity to be a mechanech, pshat is going to fly out the window. but in this case, when I think I have a better pshat, Rashi thought of that too. And yet Rashi gave his parish because, as Leon said, it's
why bother having it in the Torah?
Right, there's something to teach. Right. So someone else might say, "Don't hack me, Micheko, Miotzia. Come on, I'm out to fry bigger fish in the Torah."
That puts it into just literature.
I have repetition and contradictions and guy, other things like that to worry about. Why are you why bother me with Micheko? But that's
Rashi. Mark has a different.
Okay. Okay, Chevra. Marv. Stop, Marv. So, once again, if you can make two piles of these perushim.
Well, you can keep them if you bring them back.